Gib an.
May we start, comrade? Right. We're waiting. Waiting. Sing. I go to the ayube nokuthula lapho sokwazi ukuqala. Izobuya, don't worry. Ngiyazela ukuthi lesikhathi ubukhala ngaso sikwazi ukusibamba. Good morning, comrades, and welcome to the department and all the officials that are here. I hope we all have copies of the program. In case you don't, please indicate so that it can be made available to you. Those who do not have copies of the program, please just keep them up high. Copies of the program will be made available to you. Right. We want firstly to welcome the Minister of Home Affairs to this hearing, Mama Sagwamgela. We're happy to have you here. I see that today, for the first time, the Deputy Minister is also here. Tachabuluba Nani sees an invasion. But we welcome it and we appreciate it very, very much. We are nothing but a normal committee of parliament that does nothing than to merely seek information so that we can properly do our oversight work and report to parliament factually. We are happy to have you, Comrade Minister and Comrade Deputy Minister. May I, before we start, just to members of the committee, you'll recall that we were last together on Wednesday when we had that very difficult hearing with the Commission for Gender Equality. From my side, I have done all the things that you had requested me to do in terms of communicating some of the decisions we have taken. And I do want to emphasize to you that the communication that we have sent forth, especially in relation to the interventions that needed to be made and the subsequent, the follow-up hearings that we should have, did not seek to imply that the Speaker's office is directly responsible for the operations and function of the Commission. I think our understanding, all of us, has been that because they report to Parliament, and we understood that the Deputy Speaker's office is the one that is looking into tightening processes of oversight around them, who felt it is relevant for that office to be here, so that in its process of tying up the oversight mechanism, it could appreciate what the issues are from our side and actually assist its process. So if you have heard it the way some people have heard it, please let it be corrected. We requested nothing less than the usual, that some offices need to be here to observe and understand the process than in a somewhat different manner. And it is equally on that basis that the Minister and the Deputy Minister are here today not to answer on why there was an irregular expenditure of 10,000, but to be part of the process, observe it, appreciate what the areas of concerns are from Parliament, so that in their interaction with officials they could also assist to say no, but these concerns of Parliament have not been appropriately appreciated. But that as it may, Comrade Minister, what we are going to do, which is our normal ritual, is to give you the opportunity and your officials to introduce yourselves so we know who to Kuruma Nobani, and then the Auditor General's office will do the same. I'm not sure if National Treasury is here. If you were to be this other side and not be part of the accused, it would assist us a great deal. We don't want you to be caught in some friendly fire, because friendly fire kills, just like hostile fire. Right, so, Comrade Minister, as I was saying, from your side, then the Auditor General's Office, National Treasury, Members of Parliament introduce themselves, and then we engage. So I'll just wait for Treasury officials to take their seats, and then I will hand over to you, Comrade. Right. How we usually do it, Comrade Minister, once I hand over to you, you'll introduce yourself for those members of Parliament who don't know you. And then the officials, surely, they can speak for themselves. And then we can then take it up from there. I'll hand over to you, Comrade.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and thanks for the opportunity to come and observe your proceedings. My name is Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. I'm the Minister of Home Affairs, sitting on the side of the accused. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Mkhusela Pleni, the Director General for the Department of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chairperson and Honorable Members. My name is Madusi Kikaba, Deputy Minister of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair and Honorable Members. Nagi DG Wamaloba for Home Affairs. Mavuso Msima.
Just a minute. I don't see the accused well. I want to go and sit that side.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Eko Nadu. I'm the ex-CFO for the Department of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Jackson McKay. I'm the Deputy Director General responsible for immigration.
Good morning, Honourable Members and Chairperson. My name is Avril Williamson, new Deputy Director General, Human Resources.
Good morning, my name is John Carnison, Chief Director for Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. My name is Bosin Kize, Deputy Director General for Civic Services.
Good morning, Chairman and members. My name is Zodo Manasseh, Chairman of CETA.
Good morning. My name is Kuki Mkulwa, a CETA board member.
Good morning, Chair and members of Parliament. My name is Nontobe Gonsinde. I'm a CETA board. I'm a CETA board member.
What? The officials at the back.
Good morning. My name is Bayanda Mzoneli, Parliamentary Officer for Deputy Minister.
Good morning, Chairperson and Members of Parliament. My name is Riaz Musa, and I'm the Home Affairs Parliamentary Liaison Cabinet Support.
Can you speak a little louder?
My name is Riaz Musa. I am from the Subdirector of Parliamentary Liaison and Cabinet Support at the Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Tinle Mapulu, the Parliamentary Liaison Officer of the Minister of Home Affairs. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Tembi Simamane, Director of Integrated Governance.
Good morning, Chairperson and members of Parliament. My name is Domisile Ndlovu, Chief Director of Supply Chain Management, Department of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chairperson and members of Parliament. My name is Sonda Maguarera, Chief Director of Financial Management, Department of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Ikshan Khan. I'm the CIO for CETA.
Morning, Chair and members. My name is Johnson Kyoto. I'm with CETA.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Ramabela Makhumantide, the Acting CEO of CETA.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. My name is Moses Ntimunye, and I'm from CETA.
Morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm Nokolito Nochozi. I'm from CETA.
Good morning, Chair and members of Parliament. I'm Jan Roussel, Acting Executive Director of Human Resources at the Government Printing Works.
Good morning, Chair and members of Parliament. My name is Oka Kayser. I'm an auditor.
And you, can you speak to the mic?
My name is Oka Kayser, and I am an audit committee member at GPW.
Chair and honourable members, good morning. My name is Charles Engelbrecht. I'm Executive Director of Operations at the Government Printing Works.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Rassie Barnard. I'm the Acting CFO of Government Printing Works.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. My name is Tom Moyane. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Government Printing Works.
Thank you very much. Mr. Aplin, did I miss something here? Do we have the chairperson of the Audit Committee?
He's not here.
Why? You don't know.
Mission Shepherd, I'll check, we are not invited.
No, he was certainly invited from our side. It was on your letter that we sent to you. Now, if he's not here, it's fine, because any explanation will not produce him. All we wanted to check was, is he here and why is he not here? Because then it means that one arm of our process is already effectively and successfully sabotaged. There's a definite reason why we want the chairperson of the audit committee or the audit committee to be represented in this hearing. So if he's not here, you have hobbled us already. It was there in the letter that we sent to you. But anyway, be that as it may, let's move on. Just two things come in. One, as usual. Please, let's switch our cellular phones off. Don't even put it on silent. As we engage, the proceedings are recorded. So when your phone rings, even if it's on silent, it affects the recording. That is for the duration that will be ringing. Nothing will be recorded. So it is for that purpose that you are saying, please, can we switch them off? Secondly, I want to make an appeal to comrades, seeing that it is the first time we're having our hearing on Friday, but of course it's going to be a standing practice. And there are all sorts of concerns and challenges, which we'll probably address by starting at 8 or 7 in the morning to make sure we have enough time. I want to make a request that on all the focus areas, we'll be starting with Home Affairs. On all the focus areas of Home Affairs, as responses come, if we have follow-up issues that we want to take up, can we just note them down? And when we have finished Home Affairs, then I will allow comrades to make follow-ups. What I'm trying to say is that let's allow the members who have been allocated focus areas to go through what they have prepared. And once they have gone through, then I'll allow comrades to have follow-up questions. And then we'll then move to government printing works. Those who have been allocated responsibilities will then ask the questions they have. Once they are done, if there are follow-up issues, will then allow comrades to do so. And then at the end, I don't see the chairperson of the portfolio committee. Okay, fine, he's not here. At the end, we'll give the minister the opportunity to talk to us on the basis of her own observation of what we have gone through and maybe issues that we might have put forth that requires a political response. Otherwise, the officials are here to respond. And we want to thank Mr. Mavuso, the past Director General of the department, who we requested at what some would call short notice to be here, and he readily agreed to be here because the work that is being reviewed is the work that was under his stewardship. So I would imagine that on issues of the past, he will have all the answers. But on issues of the future, in terms of what has been done, what is being done about the issues that have been identified, I'm sure Mr. Aplin is here to talk to those. We had requested one other gentleman who used to work at CETA, Mr. Jonas Bokgoshi, almost the same time that we requested Mr. Mavuso to come. And unfortunately, all we got was a lawyer's letter indicating short notice and demanding all sorts of things and reserving his rights, which unfortunately we got yesterday, so we could not do much about it. We are very certain he would have some relevance to these proceedings, or he would assist us in getting clarity on some of the issues. But anyway, let's get to our engagement. Comrade Minister, I'm sure we all know the importance of Home Affairs. When you are born, the one door you definitely knock at is Home Affairs. When you die, it is also one door that you go and knock at. So our lives revolve around this department. Its importance cannot be overemphasized. But unfortunately, it has for some time been in a state that it definitely should not have been in. We are aware and fully appreciate processes that had been engaged to move the department away from where it was to the idea. But that has been a journey. We're still walking that journey. And as we walk that journey, we want to scrutinize and check on all the steps and identify the missteps so that as we move towards the ideal, we make sure everything is properly covered. Let me hand over to Comrade Mutambi to kickstart the engagement. Comrade Mutambi.
Thank you, Chair, and morning, colleagues and comrades. Yeah, as you've indicated, my name is Faith Mutambi. I'm a member of this committee's OPA.
Wait a minute. AG, can I hand over to you? I think we had a big delegation today. I lost it somehow. Please, my apologies. Sincerely.
My name is Tembekile Makwetu, the Deputy Auditor General.
Morning, Chairperson and honorable members. My name is Eugene Zungu. I'm the Corporate Executive at the Office of the Auditor General of South Africa.
Honorable Minister, members, and Chairperson, my name is Kibesh Lakshman. I'm the Business Executive responsible for the Audit of the Department of Home Affairs and Government Printing Works from the Auditor General of South Africa. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Margaret Soga. I'm the Senior Manager in charge of both the Department of Home Affairs and Government Printing Works from Auditor General of South Africa.
Chair, my name is Tembekile Plaki, Minister of Finance, Parliamentary Liaison.
I was temporarily threatened as Minister of Finance. Okay, next.
Good morning. My name is Unati Ndobeni from the Office of the Accountant General, National Treasurer.
Good morning, Chairperson and the honorable members. My name is Ike Mabena, Senior Budget Analyst for Home Affairs at National Treasury.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members. I'm from National Treasury, Public Finance. My name is Gillian Wolfson.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Ruzane Rasukinya from the Office of the Accountant General at National Treasury.
Thank you very much. Can we have members of Parliament introducing themselves, starting from Comrade Bonham?
Morning, everyone. My name is Trevor Bonham, member of Skopje.
Good morning, Saramanya, and a member of this committee. Faith Mutambi, Skopje.
Mandla Mbilu, Skopje.
Roy Engie, Skopje.
Sarah Peterson, Madonna, Home Affairs.
Home Affairs Portfolio Committee.
Morning. My name is Mark Steele, and contrary to the program that you have in front of you, it is Mr.
Morning. Piet Pretorius, Skopje.
Good morning. Naren Singh, Skopje.
Good morning. Nosimo Palindela, Home Affairs.
Good morning, Joe Maglua, member of the Home Affairs Portfolio Committee.
Meki Maunye, member of Home Affairs Portfolio Committee.
All right, thank you very much, Comrade Temba Godi. I chair this committee. Our sincerest apology, Honorable Steele. Mr. Steele, not Ms. Steele. Right, yes, Comrade Mutambi.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is in relation to page 93 of the annual report, payable. The report reflects that as per the end of the financial year 2008-09, we had 900,000 rand credit amount in respect of payables. Also included is an amount of 12.6 million in deposits and 11.7 million in refunds. That is in relation to the year, financial year 2004-05. I want to make reference to Treasury Regulation 17.2B and A. 2B and C, which provides that the account should be reconciled and cleared on a monthly basis. In order for the account to be reconciled, there should be a detailed listing to support all amounts in the account. It further says that a detailed listing to support all amounts recorded in this account should be maintained in order to facilitate the transfer to the immigration account. So why was this suspense account not cleared as required by the Treasury regulations that I've indicated above?
Thank you, Honourable Member, for your question. Firstly, the account has to do, as you correctly said, with repatriation deposits. In the process of cleaning up the account of Home Affairs, the amount initially started at about 50 million rand, and it progressed during the years to clean up. The process in terms of the documentation comes via the Department of Foreign Affairs, which is now DECO, and at 2004-2005, the net amount made up of the 12.6 deposits and the 11.7 expenditure, that 900,000 rand was the amount that there was no documentation for. In investigation, back in 2004-05, Foreign Affairs had approached Treasury, and this amount was written off. So on our side, we need to approach National Treasury to write this amount off. It's historical amount. In last year's annual report, the net amount was 5.6 million, made up of a 27 million credit and a 22 million expenditure. And as we worked through the account, the department reached a point where we searched our records and DECO's records, and there were absolutely no substantiating documents to clear these transactions. So right. Instead of clear...
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson, for intervention. It's a follow-up now. Why are there no supporting vouchers for the deposit receipts and the refunds made, which has meant that the amount cannot be transferred, as you said it? Why are they?
Thank you. The documentation here starts off in the missions, where deposits are pledged at missions, and the documentation comes through diplomatic bag, through Foreign Affairs, and into Home Affairs. So several hands touch this piece of paper in terms of the documentation. And over a period of time, it just was not there when it came over to Home Affairs. So we went back, we looked for documentation that we received.
All right. So what they're saying is you didn't get documentation from Home Affairs?
From Foreign Affairs.
From Foreign Affairs?
Yes.
That's your firm and factual position?
Yes.
Not your problem, it's Foreign Affairs?
No, it's a coordinated effect, because the missions is under the direction of Foreign Affairs. The documentation and the process that they hand over to us is a receipting. We sign for what we receive, and they sign for what they give us, and this is the net result of that that never came through to the department.
As a follow-up check, is there any proof that the department has exhausted all endeavors to make sure that documents are received from Foreign Affairs? I'm raising it in relation to, in terms of the IGR Act, because isn't that department are supposed to cooperate? Is there any documentary proof to show that the department on its part, it has made all endeavors to make sure that Foreign Affairs submit the documents to it?
Yes, we have exploited all avenues in terms of trying to find the documentation, both on our side and on Foreign Affairs side. And as I said previously, many years ago, Foreign Affairs approached National Treasury and had this amount written off because they didn't have documentation on their side. So we need to do the same on our side, because it would never come through.
Yeah, it is also reported that the department has made an application to National Treasury to get permission to transfer the funds without the required supporting documents. How far have you gone with that one?
Thanks, Honourable Member. We have submitted a letter to National Treasury requesting this write-off and explaining the 11 million, because the 11 million is a debit and the 12 million is a credit. And then also, when which links with the same issue, which is on page 15. So we've submitted that letter as one to National Treasury. So you can submit that dealing with it.
Colleagues, you'll recall that this has been recurring since, like I indicated, since the previous financial year. In 2006-07 and 2006-07-08, payables were disclaimed. You got a disclaimer for the previous two financial years.
So it is a late comer who still has his or her cellular phone on. For those who came on time, they've heard that they will need to keep their cellular phones off. Continue, Comrade.
And yet this financial year, there is a qualification. Can the department give this committee assurance that there will be progress in this regard? I'm raising it because the AG has found that the root cause also is that the manual and automated controls are not designed to ensure that transactions occur and that transactions are authorized and completely and accurately transferred. So can this committee be assured that there will be progress in this regard?
The issue at hand, that 12 million and 11.7 million, the only way to clear it is the approval by National Treasury, because it says you can't process transactions without supporting documents. If we don't get that approval from Treasury, that figure will still remain there because you can't process it. Hence, we have approached National Treasury in terms of the PFMA, which allows that where we prove that there is no documentation, National Treasury can take that particular decision. Going forward, that's why this amount relates to 2004 backwards, is not coming on the other side. However, because when we sat with this problem, because the issue is that you can't process something without a supporting document, and we agreed with Homer's DECOP that when we get the claim from them, we only process what has got a supporting document. What doesn't have a supporting document, we leave it aside. So going forward, we won't have this problem of processing without documentation. I guarantee that.
Follow up, Chair. But even now in the current year under review, we had similar situation, and this problem has been recurring since 2004-05. That's why I'm saying to say, now, given the circumstances on the previous financial year, how did we allow, because that comes back to my question to say, was the Department of Foreign Affairs actually involved? Because this has been a burning issue over since 2004-05, as you are saying.
Sir, it's not only Department of DECO. National Treasury, we meet with National Treasury on a monthly basis. We have submitted to National Treasury the reconciliation of this account as from 2004-05 up to date. And in the reconciliation, we have split what we confirmed per year, which outstanding documents which we have not received from DECO, and what is the repatriation account. So that reconciliation is there. Where we are with DECO is to now finalize how we're going to deal with the issue of outstanding documents. Furthermore, Honorable Member, we have signed a memorandum of understanding with DECO to resolve this issue. However, it's going to only resolve one side, which is the expenditure side, because we've agreed that we will pay DECO based on the pay sheet for allowances and as well as for rental based on the lease agreements. But revenue, there is nothing we can do with the revenue because we're on a cash base. We only recognize what we have received. But this matter, we are discussing between DICO and the National Treasurer. So we are presenting to them everyone.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. The Auditor General's frustration is that the repatriation account remains unauditable. Through your permission, I think National Treasury should also be asked, why is it not resolving? Because this thing will keep on recurring for the department and will keep on causing the...
Who are you saying should also be asked?
National Treasury.
National Treasury.
Yeah.
Is that a National Treasury problem?
Also implicated on this one.
Oh, okay.
Chair, maybe that question too should come out during departmental revenue, if we can park it, because it's still coming under departmental revenue.
Departmental revenue.
Yes,
exactly. Okay, no, it's fine. Let's leave it at that. If it is missed somehow, someone just note it, so we can come to it. Comrade Mutambi, you can continue.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm done.
You're done. All right. Thank you very much. The only issue that the DG, you need to note down is the fact that in an instance where you exchange documents with another department, I think it will be important to be able to note which documents have you not received from Foreign Affairs and which documents have you yourselves lost. So that we don't talk in general, overarching terms. Because if they give you documents and they sign, and you sign that you have received them. Let's go back to the schedules that were signed. Who signed for these documents, and where did he or she take those documents to? Because when they pass through several hands, there are people that will know it's so and so and so and so and so and so. And those people should be able to account. We can't talk of it in generic terms as if these things move through computers. Even if they do, there's somebody who press a button for them to move somewhere. Yeah.
Chair, I want to exactly on that. Chair, the documents we're talking about is what we've not received. That's why in a schedule, I will say I received a schedule with 1.5 million rand. Documents which I confirmed is 1.4. Documents which not received is 4,000. And then after that, I've got a list of what this 4,000 is. And then DICO has come back because, remember, DICO has to pay us at the end of the day. So they balance what they've received, and then based on that net, then they will transfer to Home Affairs this amount. So that's why those documents have not been lost in the department, and we are in agreement with DICO on that.
Oh, okay. All right. Now that's fine. Honorable Steele?
Thank you, Chairperson. The next section that I want to deal with is that relating to leases. It appears on page 94 of the AG's report, and also note 21 in the financial statements, which is on page 143. Chair, it might be helpful just to give a little bit of a technical introduction to this matter. It relates to financial and operating leases, and the qualification refers specifically to a lease agreement which was entered into in December 2008. The problem concerns the use or the allocation of this lease in terms of whether it's either a financial or an operating lease. And I'd just like to read for the benefit of the committee the definitions from the International Accounting Standard number 17, which apply to leases. A lease is an agreement whereby the lessor conveys to the lessee in return for a payment or series of payments the right to use an asset for an agreed period of time. And then specifically, a finance lease is a lease that transfers substantially all the risks and rewards incidental to ownership of an asset. Title may or may not eventually be transferred. And an operating lease is a lease other than a finance lease. So the bulk of the definition, the burden of the definition then falls on the finance lease, which is where the risks and rewards are transferred and all other leases are operating. Now, Chair, I have essentially three questions to ask here. The first is obviously to the Department of Home Affairs as to whether they understand finance and operating leases in terms of the international accounting standards. Secondly, I would like
a little bit. Yeah, can they just respond to that one?
That one first.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Plain? It's still at a generic level. I want a generic response.
I can respond on that. Yes, we do understand what is the difference between the operational lease and the financial lease.
Honourable Steele.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. That's helpful to begin with. Can we now move then to the specifics of the 333 million lease? And can we please know what are the details relating to that lease? And why is there a problem, as far as the Department of Home Affairs is concerned, in deciding whether it's operating or finance?
Thank you. In terms of the classification, the department had only failed on a few clauses within the contract, and the clauses related to the significant risk and rewards of ownership. The department believed that the risk and rewards of ownership did not rest with it. However, the auditors did believe that, hence the paragraph here. It's a subjective test rather than an objective test.
Okay. Can we please have some details as to the exact nature of the contract?
Yes. The contract has to do with the Who Am I Online project, in which the expenditure is paid as an operating lease over a period of time. At the point of at the end of March, no expenditure was incurred, but commitments were made over a period of time, up to 5 years, in this amount, which is disclosed in Note 21 to the financial statement. Thank you.
So, Chair, then can we please follow up and know what are the risks and rewards involved in this particular lease?
The risk and rewards primarily related to the fact that the assets are sitting on Home Affairs property, and we are responsible for the security of that because it's on our property, and National Department of Home Affairs sites are national key points. That seem to move it towards we still retain ownership in terms of that because we act in that manner.
Is there going to be any title transfer with regard to this lease, please, Chair?
The contract specifically says no. There is no title ownership in there because when the contract was framed, it was framed in our minds and understanding as an operating lease. So there is a clause that says ownership will not transfer.
Finally, Chair, can we possibly have a comment from either the AG or the National Treasury then as to how they can go about resolving this problem? I understand the issue. If there's no final transfer of ownership, that would seem to indicate that it is moving towards an operating lease. But clearly, if the risk and reward is located within Home Affairs, it's a financial lease. But can the Accountant General or the AG please advise as to how this matter can be as it were, clarified and this qualification removed?
Yeah. Can we get a response firstly from the Auditor General? Was it really a borderline case so that the department could easily have seen it as an operating lease and not as a finance lease?
Honourable Chair, all protocol observed. Let me go through the details of why we consider it to be a finance lease. The first clause
4.4 read with 14 says, upon termination of the lease agreement, Department of Home Affairs has the option to extend the lease agreement and continue with payments. Alternatively, all equipment is to be returned to Kijima in the same condition as delivered. Fair wear and tear taken into consideration. So here it implies the DH is liable for all costs relating to the return. And the rationale behind that is the extension option is reasonably expected to be taken up by Department of Home Affairs, as equipment under lease will be at that point be integral to the operations of the Who Am I Online system and ultimately the service delivery to Department of Home Affairs. So yes, Department of Home Affairs will not have similar equipment. The second one, which is clause 4.5, it is the intention of the parties that the rental period stipulated will always be less in duration than the economic life of the equipment. And the 5.2, which is clause 5.2, it says DHA, Department of Home Affairs, is liable and explicitly holds Kijima harmless against loss of damage, however arising, third-party liability claims, claims for breach of intellectual property, any loss of liability incurred by Kijima for Department of Home Affairs using or operating the equipment. And this risk effectively is carried by Department of Home Affairs, again coming to the risks and rewards. So based on that and many other clauses and share, there is quite a significant amount. I don't know if you want me to go through all. There's approximately 20 that we've looked at. We felt that the risk and rewards is transferred to Department of Home Affairs, and hence it constitutes the definition of a finance lease. We have discussed this currently with the current leadership of Department of Home Affairs, and they have had discussions with National Treasury on the issue, and there is processes in place to actually record this lease now as a finance lease and not an operating lease in the current year under review. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Treasurer, any addition?
We actually agree with the Auditor General that it is finance lease. We have received a letter for requesting condonement by the department, and we are considering that.
But were the issues that clear cut? I think yourselves and the Auditor General seem to be saying this was very obvious reading through the clauses, but the department seemed to be saying it was not that clear cut.
I mean, we don't really look at the contracts of each and every department, because we'll be spending hours and hours looking at lease agreements. But when we discuss this at the Auditor General and ourselves, technical committee, we all agreed that it is finance lease. So it to us, it was clear-cut finance lease.
Yeah, I was asking in relation to this lease, not general leases in government. And I... Yes, sir.
Chairperson, just to add, the department actually requested Treasury approval in August 2008, and Treasury granted approval in July last year, on condition that the department renegotiated the contract in the manner that the title at the end of the lease is transferred to the department. The department has not yet come back to Treasury to indicate if they have renegotiated the contract as Treasury requested.
I think the department did not come back to you, or has they come back to you?
Have not come back to indicate that they have renegotiated the contract.
And that was August 2009?
It was July 2009.
Can we get a response from the department? Or you're going to proceed thereafter?
Chair, I think that is exactly the crucial point, that the Department of Home Affairs has entered into an agreement where they have taken on risks and reward, as the AG has quite clearly spelled out in terms of the contract, and yet they are not going to be acquiring title. And this seems to me to be the fundamental problem. It's not just a matter of regularizing the accounting definition. It's a matter of a contract where risk is assumed, which has balance sheet implications, and yet there's no final title. So can we please have the assurance from the Department of Home Affairs that that will be renegotiated and regularized?
Let's hear where are we and why, since July last year, you have not come back to National Treasury.
I'm trying now to think how to put this response. Firstly, Chair, let's say we, as the agents indicated, when we engage on the matter, we agreed that this is a finance lease. However, this has got complications then. In the sense that a finance lease, there are certain processes which you need to follow before you enter into that lease in terms of the PFMA. And those are for both the lender and the department. So, Chair, with the issue which we have with them...
Not follow those processes.
No, we have followed us. With the issue which we have with the supplier is one of the issues which we are looking at. So we'll want to say that is one
What do you mean looking at? I mean, you're too circumspect for us to have a sense of what you're doing about it.
What I'm saying, Chair, is that if a lender has entered into a finance lease with a government department without complying with the National Treasury regulations, that contract might be void. So what we're saying now, that is the root, is one of the issues which we're dealing with it with the supplier as we speak.
I'm sorry, Chair, but I really believe that the committee expects more candor and detail in their explanations. We're not getting enough substance here as to what might or might not be the issue in terms of the relationship between the supplier and the Department of Home Affairs. What exactly is the problem?
Just
a minute. Comrade Minister.
I don't know whether the committee would accept that at the moment we terminated the contract, but the matter is now probably going into litigation, so we can't go into major details on this matter if the committee would accept that. Thank you.
I'm afraid, Chair, that we have to accept that if there's going to be litigation in which the department is going to be involved, then we have to accept that explanation. And it is with regret that is the conclusion to the matter. Because clearly this committee would expect a full and detailed explanation as to the nature of the contract, why it was entered into, and what are the consequences for the DOH in terms specifically of risk and reward. So I merely note my regret that we are not able to pursue the matter to that kind of level of detail that we would expect.
Well, the only thing that I can say, Comrade Minister, is that what this says to us as a committee is that the issues that were identified by the Auditor General at a very high level are a point that there were significant difficulties with the contract as it was entered. Now, beyond terminating the contract, or termination of the contract, is actually an acceptance that things did not go or are not what they were supposed to be. From our side, our interest will be, who are the people who entered into that contract? And what is going to happen to those people? Because it means things were done in a manner that sought to prejudice government or the department. What is there a process that looks at that element? Because mere termination for us is not enough. Because the issue of consequences for particular actions in government, we believe it should be a priority or should be very high on the agenda.
Thank you. The Honorable Chair would recall that the previous minister, just before she left, she announced that she would like to do a forensic audit. But unfortunately, that forensic audit wasn't started before she left. So we continued on that route. So we are waiting for the final report from the professor who's doing the forensic audit for us. So at this point, we're not able to answer your questions until we receive the audit. Thank you.
Just one follow-up then, Chair. Will this committee receive that forensic report, or will it go to the AG, or will it go to the public prosecutor? Can we be assured that we will be privy to the outcome of that investigation?
Yes, if the committee, I was going to give it to the chair of the portfolio committee, but if we need to give a copy to this committee, we'll be quite happy to do so.
But we will be happy to receive it, Comrade Minister. I would want us to move forward. I allowed you to come on this one because we had discussed before in terms of the current issues around this matter. Honorable Steele, you're done. Oh, okay. Thank you. Comrade Mbili? Yeah, Comrade Roy said we're moving fast. I'm moving fast. Comrade Mangan.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm on capital assets. Okay. In terms of Section 41A of the PFMA and Treasury Regulation 17.2.3, the department must maintain full and proper records of its capital assets. This item was qualified on the basis that the opening balance of assets recorded in the capital assets balance as disclosed in Note 27 and 28 of the financial statements was adjusted by management during the current year with a net amount of 387 million. The AG's audit findings therefore indicate that the capital assets closing balance is misstated due to the following. One, capital assets were identified that were in existence at year end but were not recorded in the capital asset register and therefore also not recorded in the capital asset closing balance as disclosed in Note 27 and 28 of the financial statement, that is page 147 to 151. My question, therefore, is how does it happen that the department does not know of the existence of its own assets? And two?
No, let's deal with that one question.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Member. And when the turnaround started in 2007, the department didn't have an asset register. And we started the process of creating an asset register, which entails finding all the assets throughout all the sites in South Africa. And the previous financial year, which is a 7-8 financial year, it was a work in progress, and we were disclaimed on assets, primarily because it was a work in progress. In the current year, the adjustment of the 378 related to the work that was done previously, hence it was the opening balance that was adjusted to get the records correctly. In terms of the Treasury Regulation, Treasury Regulation 17.2.3, the documentation related to old documentation, hence we had to do a fair value exercise. The fair value exercise was done, but the methodology was not accepted in terms of how that fair value was
was done in terms of the assets. That, subsequent to year-end, that exercise has been concluded.
Thank you. Chairperson, does the department say that it never had an asset register before, as he's saying?
Thank you, member. Prior to 2006, no, there was no asset register in the department. There was a listing of assets, but not from an accounting point of view where you consider that listing an asset register.
According to the Auditor General, he is really worried. He says the root cause of all this is control activities. Manual or automated controls are not designed to ensure that the transactions occur, are authorized, and are openly and accurately processed. As Honorable Mutandi was saying, it seems as if nothing has been happening in that department prior to 2006 or 2007, as you are saying.
Thank you, Member. Well, like I said, initially the department had a plan to run into, from going back many years, going to build up an asset register. That process took many years to do, ultimately resulting in an asset register. That's what we have now. That system is being rolled out within the department, and it's balancing back to the basic accounting system within the department. So where we stand now, previously we didn't have an asset register. In 2007-08, we had an asset register that was a work in progress. 2008-09, we had an asset register with adjustments to the opening balances, and there was a quantum of assets that were fair valued, but the methodology was not there. So going forward, firstly, there is an asset register. Secondly, there is an asset system of management with the documentation. The documentation is not referring to the year in we're talking about. And going forward, the department is rolling out that system with the asset take. Thank you.
The AG was unable to physically verify selected capital assets included in the year-end capital register. This potential misstatement impact over the capital asset is estimated at 31 million. How can the department not know that assets worth 31 million are no longer in its possession and should be removed from the register? Thank you.
Thank you, Member, for that question. In terms of the physical verification, the audit technique that the Auditor General uses is a sampling technique. So there is a sample of assets that are investigated. And out of that sample, a few assets were not found. I'm not sure of the number, but it was less than R1 million. The 31 million rand is the potential misstatement. So it's an extrapolation out of the sample over the population. The population...
No, it's fine. Even if it was 10,000 rand, but why were they not there? It's the principal more than the amount.
Well, it's part of the problem in that it was assets had moved, and it was also at that time we were working on getting all these assets. Home Affairs is an IT intensive department. The assets we're talking about here are IT assets that were not able to be found.
What does that mean? So they can just disappear.
No, Chair, I'm not saying they can just disappear. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying in the process of barcoding the assets, yes, true, you need to put in a system, not only at head office, but throughout your point of presence in the whole country, when an asset moves, the one person signs for it that it's leaving point A.
Why was that not done? That is actually the number of the question.
That was what we're doing. Where we had failed is on certain items where assets moved, because as a department, we are changing the culture of...
No. We're saying those very assets that moved. Why was the process not in place to be able to track them?
Well, that is still work in progress. Not still, but it was work in progress at that point in time. At the moment, we've got asset officers in all our points of presence throughout the department. So at that point in time, it was not there. So it was work in progress at that point in time.
Chairperson, I just want to make a follow-up on this one. Does it mean that, as we are talking now, we don't even know the person? The thing that we are looking for is the person who was working on that. If we can get the name of the person and what actually happened to that person. Maybe he has just left with those assets. Who knows? But what we want to find out is, who did that, actually?
Yeah, there is responsibility attached to people. And when things are not done, it means somebody, a warm body, did not do his or her job. Whether it was work on in progress or it was not done, it was done differently, somebody who has been employed, who gets paid every month to do that job, did not do it. That's what she's asking. Where did that responsibility lie?
The responsibility lies centrally. So there wasn't a dedicated person in each office to look after assets. That's what was the problem in the department. And like I said, it's impossible to control all your asset base from a central point. The closest individual would have been the office manager who's responsible for that office and the personnel in that office and the assets in that office. But it was not written in their job description to say, you are responsible for assets in that office. The department has now undertaken that responsibility. So we've got what we call a front office toolkit. In that, we talk about daily duties, weekly duties, and even monthly duties that cover specifically assets, revenue, and other finance obligations.
Right. Okay.
Chairperson, let's just take it as they say. Maybe really they've got other people now who are working on that. And next time when they come here, they will be telling us that Mr. So-and-so or Ms. So-and-so is working in this office and she or he is responsible for that. The next question is, Section 41A of the PFMA and Treasury Regulation 17.23 require that proper and full records are kept. Chairperson, I think he's still going to tell me the same thing. I don't think I need to ask anything on this one. Because he's still going to take us back to say that there was no one body doing that at that moment. But it was done centrally. And if it's centrally, I believe there should be somebody recording those things.
Who is that person centrally?
Just a minute,
Lamange. Who is that person centrally who was responsible for us?
He is a director in asset management, and his name is Sabelo Ngwenya.
That's the person who was responsible at that time.
Sorry, he's the director over those assets, yes.
That's the person who actually failed to develop a proper system of managing the assets.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, Chairperson, maybe they'll go and deal with that person when they go back. Can we turn now to note 27 on page 148 concerning disposals of machinery and equipment worth 17.1 million? Can the department inform the committee how this was done as no cash was received?
You say page 148?
148.
Note 27.2. Okay.
Can the department inform the committee how this was done as no cash was received?
Yes. Thank you, Member, for the question. These, as part of the asset investigation, these were old assets that were kept in store yards, literally a shed on a site, or throughout what we found in the department is that the offices throughout the country had an office where equipment was just left and mothballed. There was no economic use of it, and we had to literally dispose of it. Nobody was willing to pay to take those assets. Now, there was no scrap value in those assets, there was actually a disposal fee to actually have them scrapped and removed. So in terms of the process, it went through a process of a disposal committee where the committee requested from service providers to come and inspect if there's any value out of those. The committee then also went through a process to say, for the assets, is there a charge to dispose of it in a proper manner? And then after that, it went through the relevant approval chains to have the assets disposed of. We cannot keep assets on our record at a no value or a single rand value. Thanks.
Chairperson, but what I've realized with other departments, if there are such assets, what they actually do is to give them out to this coming up a business looking entrepreneurs, whatever you call them, for them to use, because you find that those people really can use such assets and the department doesn't use it anymore. Why don't you just give it out to those people, unlike disposing them, leaving them in a dumping site where a person who understands that, maybe even from the department, will go and pick it up again and start using it? Why don't we do that as a department?
Thank you, ma'am. We did do that. We did send out invitations. We also sent out invitations to schools to come and see what of value they wanted. And this is the end result. Nobody really wanted anything there.
What had you done to those assets, really? Say that nobody could make use of them. And I find it interesting that you would have a disposal committee when you have no asset management processes. But anyway, let's not debate that. Say that's what happened. They were so bad, no one wanted to touch them. I find that quite hard to believe. But anyway, Memanga.
Thank you, Chairperson. In Note 28.2 on movement in intangible capital assets for the year 2007-2008 on page 151, what are the other intangibles worth 113 million that were adjusted? What are those?
As I said, in last year's, not last year, the 7-8 financial year when we were doing work in progress, in the asset register, license fees, software, was recorded as an intangible asset. And it wasn't the case. It wasn't an asset. It wasn't intangible. It was actually annual license fees that were recorded as an asset. And this was the adjustment to take it out to cleanse the asset register. So it was software.
Finally, the AG identified the root cause for the qualification of capital assets as departmental controls that are not designed to ensure that transactions did occur, are authorized, and are completely and accurately processed. That is page 95, table, the first table. Can the department assure this committee that it will do not continue, it will try to continuing to improve on this area so that we don't revert to the disclaimers of 2006-07 and 2007-08. Can the department assure this committee?
Yes, sir. Chair, what were the terms of the causes, so that I can be able to say how we're mapping the process going forward? One of the major issues which were causing this was the dummy numbers which we're putting in the assets, because assets are bought centrally and distributed to all the provinces, and then there was no link between now that invoice back to the assets. So when people are completing the asset register, we'll just put dummy numbers. So last year, that numbers was 2,732 of those assets which were having dummy numbers. So we've cleared all that. Secondly, to control that now going forward, no invoice
is paid now in the department without a barcode number in that particular invoice. So that control is going to really help us now that there is no asset which now won't be able to know going forward. And we have put processes now of making sure that our additions per month, they are reconciled and be able now to understand what is it. So by this year, that we'll be able now to have our asset register control on a monthly basis.
Chairperson, I believe by him saying so, it means that even provinces are covered and won't be having any problems with them. Thank you. Chairperson, I know this is not what
I'm talking about. Was there a nodding of the head to that?
Yeah, he moved his head. He said yes. I saw his head moving.
No.
But he didn't talk.
No, I must say it in ways. It won't be recorded.
So what we are doing is the departments, all district office, regional office, provincial office, and national.
Right, okay.
Chairperson, thank you. I'm a little bit worried. You see, I'm having these pages. They are loose. if it was at a school or talking to a person, I'll be saying to this person, tell your parents to go to your principal and tell him to refund them. But this, I don't even know what to say. They are loose papers. And I know the government has paid for this. This doesn't really come as free. In future, they must take care of such things.
What happened? Why do we have this loose report?
Yes, I know. Let me start by apologizing for having a document which is loose.
Very expensive apology.
Yes, China, yeah. So we are printing this through our government printing works. Well, sorry, yes. So now as the printers, they outsource at this service. But what we have done, when we pick this problem, we've already go back to that supplier because we know who is the supplier, and we raise our concern by having a book which is getting loose, so that next time we'll get a book which is...
What about this time? Let's not talk about next time. This time.
What happens to
this time? Because this thing is loose. I've actually noted it down somewhere that I'm going to raise it. It's loose.
Yes. Yes, sir, we've gone back to the supplier and...
Okay, you did not do anything about this loose book.
Yes.
That's the long and the short of it.
Yes.
You just wagged the finger at them.
No, sir, we demanded that they must pay us for the books. They must reprint it.
And what has happened?
We have just said that to them, so they have not yet come back to us. We have raised the matter with the supplier.
But your initial statement was that next time they must give you a proper... So those are two different statements. So essentially you went to complain about the quality of the book, if at all you did. But in terms of rectifying this, there is no rectification process. That's the long and the short of it.
In terms of this book has already been printed, this one, but what we said is that they must now, because of the books which have get loose, the next copies which they are printing must be...
So there is no refunding, there is nothing, it's about next time. Yes. It's about next time. That next time they must do a better job.
Yes, but we have raised our issue about the quality of the book.
Now, you see, our concern here is how much did you pay to produce this book, this annual report?
Yeah, the cost of the book, I don't want to put a figure.
Chair, I was not involved directly in this, but when I was brought to my attention that they were loose, I briefed the DG on our communication section, went through government printing works, got a contract with a publisher, and I brought it to their attention. Now, when I briefed the DG, I think it may not have been clear enough. We have had problems with binding of our strategic plan, and that one we insisted they reprint at their own cost. This particular one, just to clarify this, we haven't realized this problem up until yesterday. So what Mr. Plenty was referring to was our previous experience. I'm not sure it was the same printer. This was bound by USS printers, which were procured through government printing works. So we have yet to take action. Previously, we did take action, and we did get them to reprint at their own cost. Now that we've realized there's problems with this one, we'll have to report. I've already reported to government printing works that they should look very closely at that particular supplier, and we will...
Since the report was released last year in September, only yesterday you realized it's not of good quality.
In terms of this particular document, yes.
All right. No, that's fine. I wanted it in relation to this particular document. But I'll deviate because he's a chairperson. But what I wanted was how much did it cost the department to print the annual report? I wanted a figure. But I'm happy with the explanation because it says the DG is talking to something different from what I'm asking him. How much did it cost to print this annual report?
You see, I will have to find out from those people responsible.
Where are the people responsible?
The communication section.
Where are they? They are not here. Okay. Comrade Roy?
If the department doesn't know the answer, may I give them the answer? It cost over 333,000 rand at about 2,000 copies. I think that works out to about 111 per...
Can you bring... Can you just pull the mic closer?
It cost a total of 333,000 rand, about 2,000 copies, altogether at about 111 rand per copy.
Can we say this was money well spent to get value for money?
As we've indicated, it is not. We have to follow this thing up, as we said.
Okay. Mangan, you see, please. We don't want this. We don't need this. We're going to ask questions. Let's just get short, pointed, correct answers so that we move forward. Well,
Jefferson, thank you. I'm done.
You're done.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, Comrade Mbili.
Thanks, Jefferson. We have this. You will pardon me, Jefferson. Because I have the same, it will make me to be disarray trying to put through my notes because of the same problem we've just spoken to. But Chetasin, the basis for the qualified report from the disclaimer, It speaks directly to the four issues. My colleagues have already engaged on the three, which is payable, leases, and capital assets. And they are interlinked with the departmental revenue. I'm saying this chapter person because maybe some questions will sound as a repetition of what my colleagues have already alluded to. But, Chairperson, I want to take you and the committee, the department, to page 92, paragraph 7. In the previous two financial years, the departmental revenue has been disclaimed, like I've already mentioned by the AG, and for the current year is qualified. Well, one should applaud the improvements in that direction. But the department revenue amounting to 365, again going back to page 92, 356, that is page 92, paragraph 7, note 2, to the financial statement comprises each sales of the civic and immigration services. This simply puts that this relates to money is paid to the department for something like passport, IDs, and so forth. Penalties levied at immigration centers. Now, the issue here with the cash sales for civic services. The requested process application document were not made available to the AG, which is a problem. This mostly comprised to the missing documents from regional offices, your regional offices. So the only alternative procedure available to the AG could only be performed on the issues of ID, with all other department revenue streams not being audited. Now, it's suggested that the root causes are that there are no proper trail, the manual and automated controls are not designed to ensure that the transaction occurred, are authorized, and are completely accurate processed. Now, before I go further, I just want to touch here to the issue. I respect the sub judice concept on the contract itself, but the question relates to the implications. What implications will that do for you to improve the situation? That system was designed to address the very same problem I'm talking to. So what implications would this cancelled contract, without getting to the merits of why it was cancelled, because I'm saying it was designed to address this particular problem. So what implications, or what are the other alternatives that are being employed by the department to address this situation? Thanks, sir.
Take the question, sir. The issue here of the documentation, first let me deal with that, and I'll come back to the one of the system. Yes, it is a fact that our documents were not able to be traced back to the enabling documents, because our documents were not regarded as face value documents. They didn't have any reference numbers. We're only having one copy. I'll make an example for an ID. For an ID application, there's a form called BI-9. So that form doesn't have a reference number. So when a person comes and apply, if it's a reissue, we'll pay us a 20 rand. And then the form leaves the office physically and go to BVR in Pretoria for the processing of the document. There is nothing left in the office. So, Chair, we found that this was a simple solution to implement, just to print the document into triplicate. A copy goes to the client. The second copy remains in the office. The third copy goes to BVR. Then that reference number be in the receipt itself, so that when AG now comes, is able to find a receipt book and then refer that number into the book. So, Chair, that was the reason why the documents could not be linked. So how we've resolved that, we've gone to Government Printing Works to reprint a multiple of our documents so that we can resolve that problem. But Chair, let me say, but that will have an effect in the 10-11 financial year, not 9-10, because 9-10 was on the same basis, though we have tried to get the document, but the effect will be in the 10-11. Then with the system, yes, we implemented the system which we called IRE, this receipting system, which was part of this, but has already been rolled out. So it is not affected, because what we have done, we looked at the
100 offices which are collecting 80% of our revenue, and then by end of March, the rollout was complete. So we are currently using the system, is with us, so it's not going to be affected by this issue.
Thanks, Chair. What if I'm hearing you well, you're saying you had a problem before with your data capturing. So that has been sorted out now, going forward.
2010-11, that won't be an issue because references, but in 9-10, we're still using the same old process.
Talk to me about the effects of this in terms of fraud, crime, people getting illegal documents. Some of us have stories. I lost an ID. The next time I was owing all the banks in South Africa in excess of 6 million. You know, I've subsequently addressed that, but the effect of this, how prevalent it is, and what are you doing about it currently?
I'll respond in two ways. Firstly, what effect will have the new process is that when we're issuing birth certificates, as an example, remember they go blank to an office. With the reference number now, the first thing we're going to be able to control is to say, this office received 10 birth certificates, reference number 1 to up to 10. Then on the revenue side, we have collected five birth certificates, which are these reference numbers. Therefore, what should be in the shelf is these birth certificates. So we're going to be able to control now because we've got reference numbers. So if somebody now has processed something without that badge, or if it is missing, we'll be able to know where it got missed. Secondly, Chair, we have implemented a system which the Minister talked about yesterday. We called it BACAM, which is based on a finger printing, which says, if now I'm this counter, I'm the only person who can open this machine. I'm the only person who can print on this machine. So if something has happened, we can be able now to trace back to an individual at a minute, at a 30 minute, at an hour. So that back system is going to assist us to identify where the fraud is happening. Then the other issue, which is what we are raising about the IDs, is what the Minister also touched about it yesterday, the issue of duplicates. It's the one now which we are putting a process now of working on that to make sure that all our data is in the National Population Register, and then we'll be able to avoid any printing of the duplicate. So at the moment, we're only sitting at about 6,000 which have not yet been resolved. So we are working on those matters.
Thank you, Chairperson. Comrade Mangena will be thrilled now to hear that finally you will be having a warm boat out there who will be held accountable, because she wanted to ask that what did you do to that person? Because the problem, the danger we are facing, is that people just do this thing, they violate the laws, they could elections and simply get away with it. And in this committee, that is not acceptable. But again, the department...
Comrade, part of your annual report is on the floor.
Oh. That is what our fair thing about by being disarray. But Chairperson, the integrated receipt engine, you call it the IRE, which is now to administer the revenue to improve control. So that is what you are saying, as well as to provide audit track. Because this matter has been seized with us, I'm sorry you were not there, but maybe your former was there. In a meeting with SCOPA on the 21st of November 2008, your department told this committee that this solution will be introduced in 65. That is what we were told at the time, which accounts to 80% of the which will account to 80% of the revenue by March 2009. Now, but you subsequently made a presentation to the portfolio committee on the 28th of October 2009. In that presentation, you indicated that the rollout now would be moved from 60 sites to 100 sites. But you still said it will account for 80% of the revenue. Now, can you tell us why the department account and the discrepancies thereof from 6 to 100 sites? If you can just educate me, but you still account for the same 80% of revenue. If I make myself clear, do I make?
Okay, then. Thank you, member. The previously, when the department had appeared before the committee, there was a plan to roll out to 60 sites that would have made up 80% of the revenue. The dynamics of Home Affairs changes in terms of where clients go, customers go, citizens of the country go to get services, and that changes. At that point in time, it was done on 2006-07 data. Then we updated the data because there were front office changes as well. Then we changed our plan to roll out to 100 sites by the end of March 2010. That makes up 80% of local revenue, with a focus also on the port of entry. So what we've got is 100 sites that makes up 80% of revenue that we collect within the country and excludes the foreign mission.
Chairperson, being that the case, having said that the questions are interlinked because they speak to these four main issues, but maybe the passing question would be, where are we now as a department? We have been actually a department in ANAC. There is a turnaround strategy in place. Things are relatively improving. They are not good enough. Where are we? When are we going to have a smile on our face for this committee? The chairperson has said it is a very important committee, department. That is all our lives depend on. Where are we now? Can we have at least something to smile about? I have a flight now to Japan. Can I smile all the way home? Are we seeing anything going forward from this department? Did you?
Yes, Chair, the smile will bring it one day, but I want to map it out how we're going to bring it. Chair, for 2009-10, which is the one which we're closing as at end of, which is past end of March. Chair, with the magnitude of the issues which we have, we are saying we will really reduce matters of qualification. That's what we're saying. And that is based on the true assessment because we understand what you must be in order for you to get into the particular level. So we don't want to say by 10-11, 9-10, we're expecting that we'll get a clean report. Because the processes, based on the issues AG has raised, we've pushed the processes, but the effect of these processes are in 10-11. So in our strategic plan, we have said 10-11 will be an unqualified report, and then 11-12 and 12-13, we are really gunning for a clean audit report. 11-12 and 12-13. in those 2 years. So Chair, we is what we are saying in the department. We really saying we have putting processes in the 10, in the 9-10, but we're gonna start getting those fruits in the 11, the 10-11. Actually,
Chairperson, I hear what the DG is saying. I appreciate the magnitude of the problem. But I mean, you are talking to a layman here. It does not inspire or convince me why is it taking so long. The problem has been there, identified. You have been working with the AG. You're saying you are meeting the AG on a monthly basis, weekly basis. Well, tell me something. What is it so difficult? You are talking about 2 years down the line from now. Despite this concerted effort, you are still telling me the current year you won't get a clean report. What is the issue?
Let me make sure, to be honest, let's take the revenue we are talking about. If those reference numbers are not there, I can't sit here and say when Utah General goes into our offices, they will be able to link all the revenue to the documentation, because reference numbers, which are the key, are not there. But with the revenue, I'm saying the one of 50.1 and 50.3, I've collected those documents. I see it. I know that the balance which I had now was only about 4 million, and I know where it is. So I will rectify that. It's going to be clean. The issue of the capital assets, I'm saying, there will be no asset in my asset register which is not going to be found on the floor. So on the asset register, I'm saying with the work which we have put, we are really hoping for the best on that one. With the payables, Chair, if Treasury, in terms of the Treasury regulations, has given me the write-off for that, it is clean. But if I didn't get, it won't. Leases is no issue. It will be there depending on the issues which we are dealing with it, but it's something which is not, we are not proceeding with those things. So that's why I'm saying, if I didn't have these two issues, I would be able to suppose these two are beyond the control now, but we've put processes in place. So I'm saying...
Chairperson, English being my second language or third language for that matter, but this explanation sounds very sensible, honest, convincing, more especially with regard to the issues of documentation. I'm saying it's a nice story that any right-minded person is supposed to listen to. But the question I have, having explained this thing so eloquently here, you have explained it to the AG, why they didn't listen to you? Why they didn't give you what you wanted, condone this thing, because you simply don't have documents and you are not going to fight. It's the same simple thing anybody should listen to. What is the difficulty you are facing to tell or to find to a common understanding with the AG on this matter?
The AG, let me protect them on that one. No, that issue is not with the AG, it's with the National Treasury. Yes, because
I'm sorry, the Treasury, the National Treasury.
Yes, but the Treasury we have submitted, they have not yet. So I don't want to say what decision they're going to take. We have submitted a request, but maybe they can, I don't
right.
know.
You are waiting for a response. Okay. Right. Lastly.
Chairperson, I'm saying this sounds okay. It sounds good. Treasury is here. Why did this matter is not being taken on board? Maybe if you can just allow the Treasury to respond, because the fact of the matter here, it's one of the bases. We have heard that one of the issues shall have been addressed going forward, which may paint a better picture. But this one, from where I'm seated, the explanation I'm getting from the DG sounds like a very, very easy thing. They are just simply no documents. Why is it taking so long for a Treasury to engage on this matter and bring this matter to final conclusion?
Treasury, how long are we going to wait for a response from you?
We only received the letter in February. Before then, we've been engaging with the department to make sure that they put processes in place to make sure that this does not recur. We actually, last year, in 2009, gave them our own staff member, an intern from our side, to go and help DICO and the Department of Home Affairs to trace these documents. Because there were also, for the 2006, 07, 08, there were also issues there where documents are not there. So we actually helped them, but we only received the letter in February. And we're going to respond by the end of April.
Right.
This matter has been there for quite some time. You only received, you are saying the Treasury only received the request. I need to be clear here. A request for what? To condone this or for what? And linked to that, is there any possibility in the view of the Treasury that the department have not put enough effort in this to an extent that you want to assist them to make sure that they produce this document? They are saying they don't have it. You don't believe them, do you?
Yeah, I want us to pass that point. The department has sent a letter. National Treasury will respond by the end of April to the letter that has been sent. So let's await the response from National Treasury. And then we can talk to that response and seek explanations or justification, depending on how they will have responded.
Yes, Chair. I hope you are not overruling me on this one, because I'm not very comfortable with the answer. However, Chairperson, because I'm saying we have been seized with this matter for years. For me, February is again 2 months down the line, which is supposed to be a matter of yes or no, depending on the reason for saying either of the two. But be that as it may, I rest my case. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. Let's await the response. And actually, for me, the issue is, why did the department only send the letter in February? And not much, much earlier, because the problem has been there all along, you know. But anyway, it has been sent. Let's await the response and take it up from there. Right, I've said that we'll finish the focus areas, which we have done. If there are any follow-up questions, comrades, on Home Affairs, let me see who is there. Comrade Roy, Comrade Steele, Comrade Pretorius. Right? So there are three. Yes,
Comrade. Comrade Mbili began his last question as a sweetheart question, and then it went into something else. I want to end at the same question in a sweetheart fashion, and say I think we've got to recognize that the department has moved from disclaimer to qualification as a result of this turnaround strategy. Now, I think it's very important for us as a committee to understand perhaps more about this turnaround strategy, so we can employ it or advise other departments, like serial offenders, like correctional services, to use the same approach. Now, I don't want the details of the strategy. What I want to know is If you have outside assistance, have you had outside assistance in turning things around? Outside assistance, for example, from Treasury, from AG, or has it been purely in-house?
Thank you, Chair. The turnaround strategy really belongs to the department with help from outside. In the past 3 years, we had a consultant group that was invited to take a broad view of the issues that had been indicated as causing problems, and these were issues of the productivity, efficiencies in the turnaround of documents, it was revenue, it was corruption, it pointed to issues of the matters that had been raised in the by the support intervention team when it came into the department at the invitation of the minister in 2006. I think if I understand the question is how successful has this been and what would be done to replicate the success elsewhere. I think the success has come particularly in the area of process remapping, in the area of document production. There were large long turnaround times, and by mapping out shorter and more efficient processes which had more security, it was possible to reduce that. What was important was that that was done under the leadership of the consultants, but within a very short period of time by the Home Affairs persons. So good practices like meetings before an action is undertaken, meeting after that has been done to review what has gone well and particularly what hasn't gone well. So that was one area which we think was important to ensure that the experience, the skills are transferred and the experience sustained over a period of time. There were limitations, I would say, regarding I think the problem always is an advisor or a consultant can only go so far. The ultimate responsibility and accountability rests with the management. Management needs to be strengthened. It has not been strong, and for most of the period under review, we had people in senior positions acting, until people were put definitively in the positions, there was always a gap there. The experience with respect to IT, for instance, has been that it's essential that even as you employ others from outside, service providers, to do the job, you do need a very strong internal capacity to manage the processes to ensure that what's dependent on the conditions are good for the service provider to carry out the service, but also to be able to detect quite early whether the service provider is efficient or not efficient, etc. So internal capacity, the experience one comes out with from this process, is critical in achieving any turnaround. I think there's been reference made to issues of corruption, which seems to be, which has been almost endemic in the department. And it is a combination of a number of processes. Human beings who are not corrupt would account a great deal for the removal of corruption, or curbing them from corrupt activities is of course the objective. However, IT systems are also very important in preventing even those who would be disinclined to not be corrupt, if I can put it like that. What the DG referred to is, for instance, the ability to know who prepared documents, so that if anything were to happen, you can trace the error to the producer of the document. So I think the turnaround has had its strong points. I think we certainly are better than we were a few years back, but there is a lot still that needs to be done, and I would say that owes to what remains to be done is to real strengthen. Now, there is a team almost complete now that is in place internally, senior team, and once the exercise of restructuring, moving people from the old structure to the new one is complete, taken a long while, we should be able to, in combination with others, see better results. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Honorable Steele.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Firstly, could I just have a very specific follow-up relating to the section on capital assets? Just noting that capital assets were reported on in terms of scope of resolutions in 207 and 208, with very specific instructions to the department as to what they should or shouldn't do. I want clarification, please, in terms of whether the DOH has a central asset management unit, and if not, why not? Because quite clearly the scope of resolutions indicated that there should be adequate centralized administration of assets, and that presupposes a proper asset management unit. So I just want clarity on that one. And then, Chair, secondly...
Right. Let's just get
deal with that
proposal, that. Yeah.
Yes, Chair, as we indicated, both the system and the people, what we have done is we've got the board system, which we've implemented in the department, is what we're using as a central system. Then in terms of the people, well, our view will be central and decentralized. Because if now I want to manage assets in Lusikisiki at headquarters, then I must forget about it. So we've got, at the moment, people who are managing it centrally, and we'll be also decentralizing.
So, Chair, can I clarify? What I mean is that in Lusikisiki you have somebody in charge of assets, and in Pretoria you have somebody in charge of assets, and the one reports to the other. That's what I mean by a central asset management unit.
What we have done, Chair, we are implementing our decentral for the provinces starting from 1st April this year. So now then we'll be cascading it down to all the areas. Yes.
We'll give you an opportunity.
Thank
for
you, Chair. If I can then go on to the issue of performance management. The AG reports on page 100 some of the problems of performance information, not relevant, not reliable, lack of appropriate information systems. And I have two questions, Chair, relating to the performance information. The one relates to a matter that is contained in the report. It's to do with the electronic document management system. On page 26, for example, it says the department was still engaged in manual sorting and indexing during 07-08, was forced to continue with this in 08-09, and the upgrading of the existing dysfunctional EDMS was included as a strategic objective for 09-10. Frankly, Chair, I'm appalled to note that a department of this size is still doing manual sorting and indexing. So I just want to know, when will there be a specific
target which the Auditor General can measure the performance of the department against in terms of implementing a proper EDMS. So that's the first issue, Chair. The second, also relating to performance information targets, I see in the citizen service section, pages 52 to 54, there are some very detailed and very specific areas of performance which the department wants to improve, and these obviously will be ones which, in terms of performance information, we will be able to assess their performance on. And these have to do with turnaround time, how long it takes to issue documents, how long it takes to do this, how long it takes to do that. But Chair, the one measure of performance that is not here, and I just want an explanation as to why it's not here, is the issue that perplexes every citizen of this country. And that is why it is that when they go to Home Affairs, they spend their time standing in a queue. Every efficient supermarket, every efficient bank measures their performance in terms of the length of time that people stand in queues. That's called 21st century service. This department has no performance indicator that simply says, we will reduce the amount of time spent in queues to 30 minutes or less, and we will hold staff accountable to that. So I want to know, when is the department going to introduce a measure of performance relating to the time that clients stand in queues? Thank you, Chair.
Right. Yeah, can I have a response?
Yes, Chair, I will start with the last question. The Minister yesterday in the speech did explain that the department has bought a queue management system, and here in Khayelitsha the system is already implemented. And then in the budget for 2009-10, if you take our strategic plan, it is there. We'll be rolling it out. So that's what we're doing. With the issue of EDMS, even that is the same. In the budget of 2009-10, there is an amount which has been allocated to implement the EDMS in the department. So that's what we're doing.
Doran? Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity. I think we must congratulate the department for at least improving on previous performances in many respects. Obviously, there are certain shortcomings still, but we're hearing what you're saying about your intentions. For example, turnaround time for the issue of IDs has improved quite dramatically. On page 8, you talk about 37 days, and on page 25, you talk about 40 days. I was a little bit afraid to read much further in your report to get to a longer period. But that's just aside. Can I just get some clarity from the DG, the new DG, about the remark he made earlier about the Gajima contract? I know it could be sub judice, but the question I'm asking is not sub judice. It's about the function of the DG versus the function of a private company. You said something along the lines that the company could not comply with the PFMA, and that's just the basis for some reason why the contract was stopped or terminated. Maybe I misinterpreted you, because the way I read the PFMA is that it's from the government side that you should comply, and the company, and part of your responsibility is to ensure that the private company complies with your requirements. So maybe you can just get some clarity on that, sir, before I get to some HR things.
Sir, I think it's exactly what we're talking about, to say we don't want to get into that. But as a department, an accounting officer, we've got your fiduciary responsibilities. But because PFMA is law, everybody has to comply with it, whether you are inside or you are outside. That is the context.
Well, that's exactly my argument. I'm not sure, and I'm not talking for the company, and I'll stop the argument here, but I'm saying the PFMA was written for government. It's written from this side towards the government, towards the private sector. And when the government enters into contracts with a private company, then the onus is on the government to ensure that the private company conforms to what's in the PFMA. And either at the time of the contract awarding, surely the government department or CETA, whoever was responsible for that, should have checked. But I'll stop there, sir. Maybe I'm touching a sensitive area here. Can I continue to
don't,
yeah. I think let's leave it at that. I think that the issue around the forensic audit
would can I refer to the department to some of the HR issues which is of importance to me. On page 224, for example, page 224 covers performance-related rewards, and I'm always specifically interested in the rewards paid to senior management, band A to band D. At a first glance at that table...
What page is that? Can you just pull the mic a little closer to you?
Page 224, table 7.4. And I'm saying at a first glance at that table, I was quite impressed because band C and band D, which reflect the top echelon, decided not to reward themselves, which is fair. But if you go further up the column and you look at band A, you would see that the total number of employees in band A is given as naught, but 14 of them were indicated as beneficiaries. So something is amiss there, which also has a direct bearing on the actual figures in the last column. If you do your calculations and you say that the north and the four is turned around and 14 people were actually beneficiaries, and the total cost available for payment to that group was 793,000 rand, you most definitely didn't pay them 5,600 each. You paid them 56,000 rand, which is dramatically more. And similarly in band B, where four beneficiaries got rewards out of a total package of 369,000, you did not repay them 9,200, you paid them 92,000 rand each. So your figures are unreliable, and therefore I'm hesitant to congratulate you on not paying bonuses to your senior staff. Something is wrong there. I'm not sure what to read into that. And I may, as consolation, say to you that you're not the first department where all these figures are wrong. So something is possibly wrong with the parcel system which puts the figures into your books. I'm not sure. But that needs certain clarity. Maybe we can get a comment on that one, sir, before I carry on?
I would want you to pass, because those figures are obviously wrong. So, and it is just to highlight that those figures are wrong, and this is not the only department. Almost all of them were found that figures just do not tally. Yeah, continue.
Can I refer to page 141? This is merely for clarity. I don't know how the system works, and I need some clarity on this. Page 141 refers to certain contingent liabilities, amongst others, a motor vehicle guarantee to employees of just more than a million rand. Now, the way I understand the civil service, the public service motor system is that, especially for the top echelon, you get your package and you can decide yourself whether you want to buy a car and what price the car is. What is the motor vehicle guarantee? Because in that instance, you don't get a guarantee. Are there other employees who qualify for vehicles for which you provide a guarantee?
No, in terms of that scheme, the government for senior managers, they have negotiated with also Standard Bank and FNB. They still provide the government guarantee for senior management. So that scheme allows that, exactly. So you've got your car allowance, but the government can still provide a guarantee for an employee.
Does it mean if you as a person default that the department is responsible for paying the money back?
Yes, if it's a guarantee, yes, it will. If now you default, then the state, that's why now Treasury, that guarantee, you take it as a department, it goes to National Treasury, Treasury records it and approves it. Yes.
Can I ask my last question? No, I'll accept that answer. I'm not too sure about
it. I thought you would follow up on that. How do you make that kind of guarantee? A person has a car allowance, you still make a guarantee. If they default, the department pays. I mean, I might not be understanding it very well.
Yeah. So a bank will grant you a loan based on a particular assessment. If the bank feels that it's not going to give me a loan for whatever criteria, then government says, I want that manager to go and do the work.
So I will give that guarantee to the bank that I'm guaranteeing that this employee will pay this loan. So that is the type of a guarantee we get. So it is given, and that guarantee is not given by a department. It goes to National Treasury.
I understand. I'm saying, why do we need that? That's my question. Because the next thing, on the column of staff debts, we're going to see an increase at some point. Why? Where does this idea originate from?
From DPSA. As I'm saying, it's a government policy, it's not a Home Affairs
policy. Not a department, okay.
So DPSA says they want the employees to access this benefit. And
for you senior managers?
Yes, because it's a government policy.
Now, I understand. That won't make it right because it's government. All I understand is not you as Home Affairs.
No.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just ask one last question on goods and services on page 129? There are a couple of items there which increased quite dramatically in 2008-09 compared to the previous year. And the one that I want to refer to is catering, the fifth one from the top. Catering was 5.5 million in 2007-08, and it's jumped by more than 100% in 1 year. Whether it's linked to venues and facilities slightly down, which jumped from 4 million to 20 or 21 million, I'm not sure, but can we get some clarity on why was there a need for eating so much in the department last year?
Pretoria.
Honourable Member, I don't have the specifics for that. What I do know is there was more activity, but there was also SCOA changes in terms of the classification of accounts. So there could be a realignment between certain expenditure, as you had indicated, from facilities into that.
Is that the matter? Which page is that, Pretoria? So I can. 129. Just a minute. 129. Goods and services. Okay. All right. Yeah, you may continue explaining. Just wanted to make sure I'm aware of the figures.
Let's say repeat what I said.
I think I'm covered.
Well, that's all we're going to say.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, before we jump over to the next my only worry, TG, is around irregular expenditure. And when you look at the figures on, what is the page, 145, irregular expenditure relating to current year, 198 million. And when you go to 23.2, you have non-compliance with tender procedure. 130 million. Non-compliance with treasury regulations, 66 million. Non-compliance with procurement requirements, 723,000 rand. Disciplinary steps taken, none in all of them. Is there an explanation for this? Amount and what is happening or what will happen.
Thank you, Chair. The explanations are recorded on page 146 at the top. The makeup, the 130, relates to expenditure that is irregular, not because of
delegation or anything of that nature, but because of a process that was followed within CETA in 2006. Therefore, that process makes the
Can you remember what the contract was all about?
It's to do the Huoma Online contract.
Oh, okay.
The other portion of the 198, the 66.8 million, has to do with, as it's written there, participation in a transferable contract without the necessary approval, prior approval from National Treasury. So it wasn't that we did something wrong, it was just a compliance issue. Subsequent to that...
It's non-compliance, right?
No.
So we didn't do anything wrong, it was just a non-compliance issue.
It's non-compliance, which is wrong, but the non-compliance is only to the extent that we did not ask permission to use the contract. And
yeah, but here the Auditor General says it emanates from payment made on deportation transport contracts that had expired. So what permission would you have sought from National Treasury to pay for contracts that had expired, that had not been renewed?
The contract that expired was a departmental contract. When the department's contract expired, the department chose to use the transversal contract with the National Treasury. And when that happened, the permission wasn't done prior to that. Subsequent to this, Treasury has approved
it. Wait, let me check with Treasury. Is that the same understanding? Because the English that is on this annual report is too condensed to explain what you're saying. What happened? Is there anyone who has the details around that aspect?
I'll ask Matthew to help or to add where necessary. What happened was the department had a contract. The contract expired, their own contract. They didn't use the National Treasury transversal contract. When that contract expired, they then started using the transversal contract without contacting us or without seeking our approval. That's what happened. Unadi? That's what happened.
That's what happened. Now, why did it happen? I mean, you know you have a contract, it has a fixed period, the period comes, goes, and you're not renewing it, and or you're not communicating with National Treasury to ask for their permission. What is the, maybe check from the AG, what is the implication of this non-compliance, and or who are the officials who are supposed to manage this contract? Who did not do their job? And what happened to those people or that person?
The contract has to do with transportation within the NIB environment. The utilization of the transversal contract from National Treasury.
I'm saying who was the person who was supposed to have monitored this contract, renewed it, or contacted National Treasury to ask for permission to use their transversal contract.
The name of the individual is, if we must give the name, is Ricardo Abraham in the NIB directorate.
So what happened to him? What happened to him after continue to incur in a regular expenditure?
The incurring of the irregular expenditure is not seeking permission. That's the only thing that makes utilizing the contract irregular. Nothing else.
I understand.
So
what you're saying is nothing happened because it's not a serious thing. I mean, just say yes, that's what happened, and we leave it.
Nothing happened to the individual.
Right, okay.
Yes.
No, that's fine. That's what I wanted. So that we don't. And the other irregular expenditure of 723,000?
Sorry, Chair?
Oh, the 723,000. I see it was condoned. Non-compliance with procurement procedures. It was condoned, but what happened to those people who didn't follow the procedures? Why did they not follow the procedures?
The expenditure that we're talking about in that relates to instances that happened during the department over a period of time. There had been processes that were followed, and in terms of the condemnation, you cannot condone an expense if something needs to happen, for example, disciplinary action or things of that nature. The department can't condone that. It needs to go to a National Treasury, at the National Treasury level. In these instances here, the non-compliance were within, the non-compliance was not of a magnitude that required, in terms of the department policy, to be disciplined or dismissed or anything of that nature. So it went through a process, and up to which it was condoned within the department at the appropriate level, which is the DG level.
Why did the department not comply with the public service regulation in that, as the AG says, numerous of your employees received overtime payment in excess of 30% of their basic salary?
That instance, in
terms, what has happened to the officials that approved and processed this payment?
Those payments, firstly, nothing happened. Secondly, in terms of the overpayments that is referred to on the AG's report, it has to do with security personnel that work more than the standard hours. In terms of the BAS system, the 30% limit is there for everybody. Now, there are officials within the department that by their nature of work are required to work more than 30% of the time. And this is the instance that was picked up within the department.
But is that not recognized by the public service regulation?
No, it's not.
So if you do that, you are violating this regulation?
In effect, you are. Yeah.
So why would you violate it? Because they are there to be observed. I mean, unless if you are saying these are unreasonable, and the question will be, what engagement has been entered into with DPSA to make sure that they take due recognition of some situations like you're explaining, rather than to just do it anyway?
There's two alternatives. In terms of, yes, we have engaged with DPSA, albeit on an informal basis. The other alternative is to employ more individuals so that the time can decrease. The third alternative is to outsource the service to a service provider like Kulani or whatever, and that won't fall within this area.
Two things that it should have done. One, should have employed more people. Two, should have engaged DPSA, and have not done any of these two. I don't want to pursue it and say why, because it goes back to that whole issue around management and leadership. I mean, you talk to them informally on an issue that has to do with the violation of regulations. Right. But that, as it may, I hope, DG, you are noting that down. So you can engage so that we don't have these things, because for us these are red flags that if they're not managed properly, just like if you look at expenditure, supply chain management, it's an evidence of matter. It was not there in trials. Based of accounting, it was not there. It's now an evidence of matter. So these things, if they are not properly managed, they deteriorate and become a major item or major issue. Right. Let's let go of Home Affairs, recognizing and appreciating the fact that a lot of effort has gone into pulling the department away from where it was, but there is still indeed a lot of work that needs to be done. We want to move to the second part, which is to deal with the government printing works. I will also not speak for them, but I do know that the last time we engaged with them, their report was very bad. Very, very, very bad. And I, in a subsequent meeting with Mr. Moyan, and there are indeed improvements. But what we want is a clean audit. So to take us through that, I will hand over to Comrade Roy. Comrade Roy?
Thanks, Chair. Now, you're quite right. It isn't a terribly bad report. It's still not good enough, though. Because I think what we're all aiming for, Chair, is our clean audits. And unfortunately, this time round, this entity gets a qualified audit. Two qualifications. The first is around the question of inventory, which I think, I don't have my program, but I think Mr. Singh, he's going to be dealing with that. But I want to deal briefly with the second qualification, which features on page 178 of the annual report. I want to deal with the question of accounts payable. And under the qualification regarding accounts payable is this whole question of the suspense account. And Chair, you know that in previous engagements with other departments, we've referred to the suspense account as the suspicious account. Because there are all kinds of things that go in there and one doesn't know where they're coming from and where they ought to go. And you'll know that this suspense account is a temporary account. It's when a transaction is engaged in, and at the time of the transaction, you're not too sure under what account it should go under. So you have this temporary account, the suspense account. That's all very well, but it's accounting practice that on a very regular basis, you must clear that suspense account, and you must apportion those amounts in the suspense account to where they belong, to their proper accounts. Is anybody listening? Anyone listening to me?
Such movement.
I thought I was being
asked. Please, let's maintain shape.
So the suspense account must be cleared on a regular basis. That's accounting procedure. And in this particular case, we have a regulation, a Treasury regulation, which says that every month this suspense account must be cleared and these transactions must be recorded in their proper place, in their proper accounts. And one of the qualifications found by the AG is that this very simple instruction, clear your suspense accounts once a month, has not been done. And that's a great pity because unless there's huge obstacles to doing that, I don't understand why this even appears here as a qualification, why this regulation is not being adhered to. So if we could get some explanation from the people present regarding that qualification.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Member. I think if one looks at the whole issue about the suspense account, one needs to take in cognizance the whole historical issue about data management in GPW over a number of years. Now, on this specific issue, collection has always been a problem for many years going back. Just to give a comparative figure, in the 2007-08 year, we collected 410 million from our debtors. In the year under review, we collected 560 million from our debtors. Now, when we receive money, it goes to this, we call it a control account, the Auditor General calls it a suspense account, but for me it's more a control account. So all the money goes into that account, and once it's in that account, one needs to allocate it to the various debtors' accounts and to specific invoices that is being paid. We do have tremendous problems at GPW because we don't necessarily get all the necessary documentation from departments or government entities paying us in order to allocate those payments. The amount that is stated there, of the 22 million...
So, I'm going to be clear. It's not a matter of... I'm right. It's not really a matter of collection. It's a matter of what you do with the funds and the accounts and the invoices once these funds come in, once the payments are made. That is where the problem lies. Am I right?
So, at the time of the audit, of that 22 million, there was an amount just over 4 million which we couldn't exactly indicate who has paid and what have they paid. And that is a problematic issue for us, and even in this current year, because we do receive a lot of funds coming in to GBW, especially in the last week. Just this last week of March of this current financial year, this is just passed, we received more than 175 million just during that week. So in order to allocate all that, and without properly have all the proper documentation, it is problematic. We do...
And who's who are you blaming? You're in a sense saying it's not your fault, you can't accede to this regulation because there's a lack of documentation. Not your fault. Who is to blame? Why do you not have this documentation? What steps are you taking? You mentioned other departments. What steps are you taking to ensure that you get this documentation from other departments timeously? Because one must note, if you look at the AG's report, on page 179, the matter is getting worse. We're talking this year of amount of 22 million. Last year it was 16 million. Now, unless one deals with the problem, then this clearly is going to be ongoing problem. The amounts are going to get bigger. It's going to be another qualification next time. And so what I really would like to hear, Chair, yes, we now all understand the problem, you see, what is being done about it? Or is it completely out of your hands? Are you completely at the mercy, utterly at the mercy of these departments, terrible departments, maybe Home Affairs, who are not cooperating with you?
Chair, I think we're not saying it's totally out of our hands, because there are things that we can do as GPW to be more proactive. Unfortunately, we don't have the necessary systems in place yet in order to deal with these matters, and that's something that we're dealing with at the moment. It's not just a case where we're saying we just blame everybody else.
Okay.
But as far as the debtors management per se is concerned, we've employed now our practices on the normal credit control basis.
Okay, fine. Continue, Cumbria.
Yes, you don't have the systems in place. And in fact, if you read through their report, if you look at their strategy plan, it's quite clear that one of the serious obstacles is capacity, lack of systems, and lack of warm bodies doing the tasks that are meant to be done. Let me just move on. So that is the first part of that accounts payable qualification. The second part of that same accounts payable qualification is this question around financial liability, and the AG finds that the goods received control account included long-standing amounts, and he gives the figure, some dating back to 2005-2006. And the result of these matters not being dealt with is that there is a distorted, your financial position is distorted, because it affects the payables, it affects the expenses, it affects the accumulated reserves. So here again we have an ongoing problem stemming from 2005, which has not been addressed. Why is it not being addressed? And are we likely to see this again as part of this qualification? And are you going to say now again, oh, we don't have the systems in place, we don't have the personnel?
Chairperson, the issue about this is that unfortunately it goes back to years 2005-06. The problematic area here is that because we need to comply with international accounting standards, these liabilities were recorded in previous years. So it's not just a matter, I can't find the documentation and I can just clear this account. This is clearly an account we need to reconcile, because this is actually a control account. And this account has not been cleared for many years, but at least in this account we've shown some improvement. during the year under review. Where we are now...
No, we must acknowledge that. We must acknowledge. Last time round it was 8-odd million, am I right? Now it's 4, so yeah, there has been improvement.
But
what do you attribute this improvement to? And would you use these same measures going forward so we don't see this in the next financial report?
Say, we've put certain control activities in place. Where we are today is that account is cleared.
Okay.
So we shouldn't have this problem in the future again.
Okay. But you would agree... Okay, let's move on. But you would agree with me generally with regard, I suppose, both the inventory and to the suspense account and to these things around financial liability. You would agree with me that there is perhaps insufficient internal control in the entity. Because if you look further in the AG's report, on page 181, 182, he lists 22 indicators of internal financial control. Mm-hmm. And out of those 22 indicators, you only pass on 9. 9 out of 22 where he gives you a tick. The rest are crosses where you, well, not crosses, but under the no column. So you only really meet 9 out of 22 of these internal control indices. That's a pass rate of 40%. Again, what is it? Personnel? Systems? What is it?
Just before your response, I want to encourage everyone in this room.
To do what?
To be focused only on what we're doing here.
Oh.
So that we don't have other distractions. Right? Can you respond?
You fail out of 22 internal control indicators. Your pass rate is 9 out of 22. That is a pass rate of 40%. I was a teacher. I think, Chair, you were a teacher. That's really a bad failure rate.
Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee, we take cognizance of the concern that you're raising in terms of the compliance issues that you're raising. The issue at the center of this particular issue matter is that there are two items that need to be attended to. One is that there is a lack of sufficient personnel under the period under review, and that has been since been addressed in the current financial year. Secondly, the other constraint that we had at the time is that we did not have sufficient systems in place. We are currently implementing an ERP, System Enterprise Resource Process, which will help us immensely to be able to deal with the matters that have been indicated here. We had also a discussion with the Auditor General, you know, a discussion in the financial year under review on these issues as to how we'd like to address them. We can assure the scoper that these matters are being attended to as efficiently as we'd like to see them in order to make GPW to be compliant with the Treasury regulations.
Okay, you say that one of your problems is personnel. If I look at your strategy document for 2010-11 to 2012-2013, you quite correctly emphasize the importance of the internal audit function. And many of these issues are related, internal audit, internal controls. But in this very document,